Scripture. Although there were solemn pledges that acceptance of this new statement would be voluntary, it soon became obvious that it would be imposed as a mandatory creed on all convention officers, employees, deans, and professors of colleges and seminaries, and even missionaries who were serving in foreign countries. The strictness of this mandatory compliance has exceeded that in the Roman Catholic Church or within other Protestant denominations. The new creed was troubling enough, but it was combined with other departures from historic Baptist beliefs, including the melding of religion and politics, domination by all male pastors, the exclusion of traditional Baptists from convention affairs, the subservience of women, encroachments on the autonomy of local churches, and other elements of a new fundamentalism. It became increasingly obvious that our convention leaders were really in conflict with traditional or mainstream Christians. After much prayer and soul-searching, Rosen and I decided to sever our personal relationships with the Southern Baptist Convention, while retaining our time-honored Baptist customs and beliefs within our own local church. Almost total dominance of Baptist pastors over laypersons has been implemented, based on this statement of a prominent conservative leader, W.A. Criswell, and I quote, "Lay leadership of the church is unbiblical when it weakens a pastor's authority as ruler of the church," unquote. This premise violates Jesus' announcement that he was a servant, that his disciples would be servants, and that the greatest would be servant of all. There is certainly no biblical use of the word ruler, but this self-promotion of pastors was made official in 1988 and now applies generally throughout the Southern Baptist Convention, most state conventions, and especially the megachurches. The most recent move is the convention leader's decision to withdraw from the Baptist World Alliance, an international organization that the Southern Baptist Convention helped to organize and in which it played a key role for a century. Their surprising claim is that the Baptist World Alliance has become too liberal for their continued association, a claim deeply resented by heroic European Christians who fought the oppression of Soviet communism and endangered their lives by clinging to their traditional religious heritage. This focus on events within my own religious denomination may not be especially interesting to some listeners, but it has had a profound impact on every American citizen through similar and related changes being wrought in our nation's political system. During the last quarter century, there has been a parallel right-wing movement within American politics, often directly tied to the attributes of like-minded Christian groups. The revolutionary new political principles involve special favors for the powerful at the expense of others, abandonment of social justice, denigration of those who differ, failure to protect the environment, attempts to exclude those who refuse to conform, a tendency toward unilateral diplomatic action and away from international agreements, an excessive inclination toward conflict and reliance on fear as a means of persuasion. When I teach my Bible classes, I try to explain the essence of our faith and inspire listeners to correlate Christianity with our own daily lives. The divisive debates that seem to obsess the modern Christian community do not match very closely the messages I usually choose. One Sunday, I asked a large class, mostly visitors, to name the items now being discussed most widely among their various denominations. In addition to some social issues, they quickly named mandatory prayer in schools, the use of public funds to support religious education, the service of women as leaders, evolution, public display of the Ten Commandments, the autonomy of local congregations, forced acceptance of creeds, the exaltation of pastors, and the breakdown of barriers between church and state. There was no mention of theological or religious questions that involved our common goal of worldwide evangelism or how to implement the teachings of Jesus Christ in our daily lives. It was clear that much of our energy is spent in internecine warfare, in arguments and debates that not only are divisive, but tend to incapacitate us as we work in the name of Christ. We agreed that there was still a gratifying degree of harmony within most local congregations and that the arguments were at a higher organizational level. When there is an expression of favoritism, domination, or animosity within religious community, it tends to authenticate the same attitudes among secular or even governmental groups who have personal prejudices. It is no accident that our Christian churches, at least in the South, have been well known as the last bastions of racial segregation. Also invidious, and now quite openly and generally accepted, is discrimination against women. These kinds of religious decisions are based on highly selective choices of scripture by dominant white males, and ignore the overall premise of the actions and teachings of Jesus and leaders of the early Christian church. The many differences among Christians create confusion, fragmentation, and even acrimony, and it is difficult for individual believers to comprehend and adhere to the fundamental elements of our faith. The broader consequence of all these divisions is that global evangelical work suffers and our reputations are tarnished as we contend with one another. Instead, religion should provide a way to heal the differences that separate people, based on the paramount law that Jesus taught, to love our neighbors as ourselves. Perhaps the most broad and inclusive range of opinion among American Protestants is within the National Association of Evangelicals, a group with which I feel compatible on most issues. In addition to the protection of life, their agenda places a heavy emphasis on peace, the restraint of violence, strengthening of family life, protection of children, justice and compassion for the poor and vulnerable, the preservation of religious liberty, the safeguarding of human rights, and protection of the environment. In their latest statement in April 2005, there's a call for strict, quote, just war restraints on the initiation of armed conflict, with war only as a last resort, plus an expression of concern about global warming. Not surprisingly, leaders of the religious right opposed the majority of evangelicals on these latter two issues. There are notable precedents for Christians to absorb strong differences and still work together to further God's kingdom. The early church survived when the fundamentals of faith offered adequate bonds to overcome dissension and unite the fallible and argumentative Christians. Perhaps, once again, we might be reconciled through emulating the actions and teachings of Christ and following the entreaty of St. Paul to the early churches. To the church in Corinth. Now I beseech you, brethren, in the name of our Lord Jesus Christ, that ye all seek the same thing, and that there be no divisions among you, but that ye may be perfectly joined together in the same mind and in the same judgment. And to the church in Rome. Now the God of patience and consolation grant you to be like-minded one toward another according to Christ Jesus, that ye may, with one mind and one mouth, glorify God, even the Father of our Lord Jesus Christ. Chapter 5. No conflict between science and religion. One of the most ancient and persistent debates, especially in the United States, has been between science and religion. I was chairman of the Sumter County Board of Education during the early 1960s, and the famous Scopes monkey trial in Tennessee was still a subject of frequent discussion, even after 35 years had passed. We were aware of the debates among school administrators both in Georgia and in other states about teaching evolution, but we managed to avoid contention on this issue in our county, perhaps because dealing with racial integration of the public school system provided enough controversy to keep everyone occupied. I am thankful that this dichotomy between the two opposing forces has never been either a political or a personal problem for me. As a graduate student and as one of the earliest participants in utilizing nuclear power for peaceful purposes, I was eager to expand my knowledge of physics and the other sciences. This did not in any way threaten my religious faith, since I had been fortified since childhood with the frequently recited Bible verse, quote, "Now faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen," from Hebrews 11:1. I had always understood that we didn't need scientific proof of the existence or the character of God. In fact, whenever there was adequate physical evidence to prove any theory or proposition, then we didn't need faith as a basis for our belief. Even for those without specific religious convictions, the inner feeling of what was right and wrong, and the awe-inspiring beauty of starlit sky or sunset, the emergence of a butterfly from a chrysalis, the industry of an ant, or the sprouting of a seed were adequate proofs of God's hand in our lives and in creation. It seems obvious to me that in its totality, the Bible presented God's spiritual message, but the ancient authors of the Holy Scriptures were not experts on geology, biology, or cosmology. and were not blessed with the use of electron microscopes, carbon dating techniques, or the Hubble telescope. I've never been bothered by verses in the Bible stating that the earth is flat or has four corners, that stars can fall on the earth like figs from a tree, or that the world was created in 6 calendar days as we know them. Whenever there is a scientific discovery or a theory that is proven by the observation of facts, these are just additional revelations to fallible human beings of truths that have always existed. They cannot possibly have an adverse effect on the status of the omnipotent creator of the entire universe. As scientists discover or reveal new information about the natural world, the discoveries must be correlated with one another in innovative theories. Each theory is then intensely and rigidly tested by subsequent observations, which provide either additional proof and acceptance, or error and rejection. This is how truth is revealed. The existence of millions of distant galaxies, the evolution of species, and the Big Bang theory cannot be rejected because they are not described in the Bible, and neither does confidence in them cast doubt on the creator of it all. God gave us this exciting opportunity for study and exploration, never expecting the Bible to encompass a description of the entire physical world or for scientific discoveries to be necessary as a foundation of our Christian faith. One of my favorite writers on scientific subjects was Stephen Jay Gould, with whom I corresponded on occasion. In 1989, he wrote what I consider the most enjoyable of his books, Wonderful Life, The Burgess Shale, and The Nature of History. Although some of his theses were later disputed by other paleontologists, I thoroughly enjoyed the descriptions of the weird creatures that had emerged from a transforming climatic change about 500 million years ago. He referred to their subsequent evolution as something like a tape going through a machine, with the results being attributable to a completely haphazard recording. I wrote him a private letter, expressing my belief that there had obviously been some logic or order in the process. He didn't respond directly, but subsequently quoted and slyly ridiculed my opinion in one of his monthly magazine articles, later part of a book. About 2 years before he died in 2002, he sent me a copy of Rocks of Ages, his intriguing book that was designed to resolve his conflict between science and religion. His approach was to separate the two completely in what he called non-overlapping magisteria. The great observations of science would define the natural world, and the overall teaching or magisterium of religion would define the spiritual world, and they should not intrude on each other. For me, this was an acceptable approach. There's no place for religion in the science classroom, but it will not end the commitment of some devout Christians to reject all aspects of Charles Darwin's explanation of evolution, or any geological discoveries that indicate an Earth that is more than 6,000 years old. Neither did Gould's approach match my own personal belief that God created the universe and that new scientific discoveries, when proven, must be accepted even if they are not compatible with some of the biblical descriptions of creation and the centrality and configuration of the earth and heavens. There will always be people who insist on one aspect of knowledge to the exclusion of the other and are plagued with the realization that religion and science cannot prove each other. This doesn't bother me. We are all born with free will to accept or reject whatever we choose. At the same time, we have no right to deprive other people of the freedom to study and to accept or reject that propositions are put forward as truths. Many years ago, I wrote a poem that expresses my own difficulty in comprehending it all, and I quote, "A contemplation of what has been created and why." I tried to fathom nature's laws, from twirling models and schoolroom sketches of molecules and parts of atoms, and nearly believed, but then came quarks, bosons, leptons, antiparticles, opposite-turning mirror images, some that perforate the earth, never swerving from their certain paths. I've listened to conflicting views about the grand and lesser worlds, a Big Bang where it all began, of curved, ever-expanding space, perhaps tremendous whirling yo-yos that will someday reach the end of cosmic gravity and then fly back to where they can restart or cataclysmically blow apart. And then the next event. And is it all an accident? I feel sure that it is not all an accident. Chapter 6, The Entwining of Church and State. During the last two decades, Christian fundamentalists have increasingly and openly challenged and rejected Jesus' admonition to render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's and to God the things that are God's. Most Americans have considered it proper for private citizens to influence public policy, but not for a religious group to attempt to control the processes of a democratic government, or for public officials to interfere in religious affairs or use laws or tax revenues to favor certain religious institutions. Although the issue was prominent when John Kennedy's Catholicism was debated, I also reintroduced, inadvertently, the subject of religious faith into a presidential campaign. One night in 1976, at the home of a North Carolina political supporter, I was asked point blank if I was a born-again Christian. There were news reporters there, and I truthfully answered yes, assuming that all devout Christians were born again of the Holy Spirit. This was the first time that this religious characterization had been injected into the political arena, and there was an immediate furor with media allegations that I claimed to be receiving messages directly from heaven and thought I was endowed by God with some elements of sanctity and superiority over other candidates. From then until the end of the campaign, national reporters made a big deal of what had seemed natural to me and my Baptist host, making clear to me that injecting religion into politics was a mistake. Rosalynn and I had a wonderful opportunity to violate this basic principle when I had a cautious inquiry in 1979 from the Vatican about a possible visit from Pope John Paul II, less than a year after he was elected to the papacy. I was delighted to send an official invitation, and this became the first and only papal trip to Washington, D.C. The new pontiff was already demonstrating his commitment to call on as many of his parishioners as possible, and had been to a number of Latin American nations. He made a leisurely visit, spending almost 2 days in the capital area, and we had time for some long discussions. His Holiness had a wonderful sense of humor and, in addition to several other languages, spoke English well. We recalled how much animosity there had been when John Kennedy ran for president, with allegations that if he was elected, the American people would see the Pope in the White House. When I introduced John Paul to some visiting congressmen, I pointed out that the predictions of the Protestant protesters 19 years earlier had finally come true. I expressed my gratitude for the Pope's efforts to reach out to other Christians, and also to Jews and Muslims, and for his obvious commitment to instill a global vitality in the Church. He seemed to welcome a free exchange of views, and I disagreed with him on his perpetuation of the subservience of women and their exclusion from the priesthood, which I consider to be a departure from their roles in the early Christian Church. This was a harmonious exchange, but there was more harshness when we turn to the subject of liberation theology, which is still a matter of sharp debate in Latin America. Most countries in the area were ruled by military dictators at that time, and many priests and bishops, whom I consider to be heroes, were speaking out sharply in protecting the rights of the oppressed poor and indigenous people. Invariably, John Paul II condemned the human rights activists and supported the more orthodox church leaders who were aligned with despotic and abusive regimes. I thought he was more interested in loyalty to the Vatican than to those who endangered their own lives and priestly status by ministering to the people who were suffering. The extremely conservative organization Opus Dei, Work of God, was given strong support from the Vatican. Its founder was later canonized as a saint, and its leaders had great influence in the Church. In the Pope's defense, my national security advisor, Zbigniew Brzezinski, pointed out that John Paul was heavily influenced by his background in Poland and his knowledge of other Eastern European countries, where the priests or bishops who disagreed with Rome were inclined to be communists. Nevertheless, this and other Vatican policies have resulted in a massive shift of Catholics to Protestant congregations. I enjoyed a visit to the Vatican on a subsequent trip to Italy, and Rosalynn and our daughter Amy later paid their personal respects to the pontiff. Although I felt closer to the theology and pronouncements of Pope John XXIII, there is no doubt that John Paul II was a truly great leader, with deep moral convictions and an unequaled ability to express his Christian beliefs to the world. There has never been a more charismatic and popular pope. I was careful to separate my official status as president from the private worship habits of my family, but I worked behind the scenes with Southern Baptist Convention President Jimmy Allen to develop what we called Bold Mission Thrust, an innovative convention program designed to expand the global evangelistic effort of Baptists. I prayed more during those 4 years in the White House than at any other time in my life, primarily for patience, courage, and the wisdom to make good decisions. I also prayed for peace for ourselves and others, especially Israel and its neighbors. When Iran was holding our hostages, I asked for their safe return to freedom. Since the publication of my religious books, Living Faith and Sources of Strength, I have been asked whether my Christian beliefs ever conflicted with my secular duties as president. There were a few inconsistencies, but I always honored my oath to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States. For instance, I have never believed that Jesus Christ would approve either abortions or the death penalty, but I obeyed such Supreme Court decisions to the best of my ability, at the same time attempting to minimize what I considered to be their adverse impact. Jesus proclaimed that his ministry was to bring good news to the poor, to proclaim freedom for the prisoners, recovery of sight for the blind, and to release the oppressed. This statement has always been known to Christians, but after a lifetime of responsibilities in both religious and political arenas, I reached what was to me a surprising and somewhat reluctant conclusion. In efforts to reach out to the poor, alleviate suffering, provide homes for the homeless, eliminate the stigma of poverty or racial discrimination, preserve peace, and rehabilitate prisoners, government office holders and not church members are more likely to assume responsibility and be able to fulfill the benevolent missions. The government and the church are two different realms of service, and those in political office have to face a subtle but important difference between the implementation of the high ideals of religious faith and their public duty. In a speech to my fellow Baptists in 1978, I tried to explain the duality of my personal responsibilities as a president and as a Christian, and I'll quote this speech. Thomas Jefferson, in the original days of our country, said he was fearful that the church might influence the state to take away human liberty. Roger Williams, who created the first Baptist church in our country, was afraid that the church might be corrupted by the state. These concerns led to the First Amendment, which prohibits the establishment of any official state church, and in the same sentence, prohibits the passing of any laws that might interfere with religious freedom. Separation is specified in the law, but for a religious person, there's nothing wrong with bringing these two together because you can't divorce religious beliefs from public service. At the same time, of course, in public office, you cannot impose your own religious beliefs on others. Still quoting my speech, in my office in the White House, I have to deal with many domestic and international problems. Peace, freedom, nuclear explosives, the sale of weapons, terrorism, rapidly expanding populations without adequate food or health care. But this is more than a list of political problems. These are also moral problems for you and me, because they involve the very precepts of God in which we believe. I want our country to be strong enough in all elements, military and otherwise, so we never have to prove we are strong. Reinhold Niebuhr, in his book, Moral Man and Immoral Society, pointed out the difference between a society and people. The expectations from a person are a much higher standard. A person should have as our goal complete agape, or self-sacrificial love. The most we can expect from a society is to institute simple justice. So we as people have to do better, particularly if we are blessed with the opportunity to demonstrate our worth. Leaders also have to be careful not to be too timid. A country will have authority and influence because of moral factors, not its military strength, because it can be humble and not blatant and arrogant, because our people in our country want to serve others and not dominate others. And a nation without morality will soon lose its influence around the world. What are the goals of a person or denomination or country? They're all remarkably the same. A desire for peace, a need for humility, for examining one's faults and turning away from them, a commitment to human rights in the broadest sense of the words, based on a moral society concerned with the alleviation of suffering because of deprivation or hatred or hunger or physical affliction, and a willingness, even an eagerness, to share one's ideals, one's faith with others, to translate love in a person to justice. During the 27 years since I made that speech, there's been a much more public effort to break down what Thomas Jefferson espoused as a wall of separation between church and state. Referring to this premise, the host of 700 Club, Pat Robertson, said, and I quote, "There's no such thing in the Constitution. It's a lie of the left, and we're not going to take it anymore," unquote. He repeatedly attacks public schools and calls for their replacement with religious academies. Chief Justice William Rehnquist, in the U.S. Supreme Court minority opinion, has written, and I quote, "The wall of separation between church and state is a metaphor based on bad history, a metaphor which has proved useless as a guide to judging. It should be frankly and explicitly abandoned." In 2000, Southern Baptist Convention leaders dropped from that new creed, quote, "The state has no right to impose taxes for the support of any form of religion," unquote. They have subsequently espoused vouchers for private schools and a constitutional amendment to authorize mandatory prayer in public schools, and they are openly challenging the strict separation of church and state. Government funding of social programs through faith-based initiatives appeals to religious groups who have no qualms about breaking down the historic wall between religion and government. They substitute certain charitable services in a religious environment for more broad and equitable government programs that address the wider needs of the poor for economic justice, with access to training for jobs, affordable housing, health care, sound education, and a livable wage. These initiatives bypass the historic implementation of the First Amendment by channeling taxpayers' dollars to churches and other religion-based providers of social services under contrived rules that allow for proselytizing and putting religious tests on hiring employees. The initiative even provides taxpayers' money to build and renovate houses of worship. There's no doubt that the goal is to finance programs that are clearly religious, and the annual level of somewhat surreptitious government funding through religious institutions has now reached about $2 billion. Perhaps one of the strangest and most disturbing examples of this political effort by right-wing Christians has been to attack the federal court system itself after Senate Democrats failed to approve a handful of the most conservative nominees for federal judgeships. They ignored the fact that this was the same number as Republicans had successfully opposed among Bill Clinton's nominees. Senator Bill Frist, the highest-ranking member of the United States Senate, aligned himself in a public telecast with a fundamentalist religious group to promote false claims that Democratic senators who opposed a few judges were conducting, quote, "an assault against people of faith," unquote. The group's leader announced that the activist judiciary poses a greater threat to representative government than terrorist groups. Dr. James Dobson, another sponsor of the event, called the Supreme Court unaccountable, out of control, and a despotic oligarchy, and accused the justices of a 40-year campaign to limit religious liberty. At a subsequent press conference, President George W. Bush disavowed the connection between religious faith and opposition to the appointment of federal judges. In fact, most of the judges who are targets of this well-orchestrated religious attack are devout Christians. 10 of the 13 federal appeals courts actually have a majority of Republican appointees, as does the U.S. Supreme Court, which elected a president in 2000 with a 5-4 partisan ruling. In effect, Senator Frist was helping to promote the premise that any senators who vote against extremely conservative judicial nominees are opposed to a right-wing brand of state religion. This may be a violation of the U.S. Constitution, at least in spirit, which prohibits any government effort to impose religious views on Americans. Shortly after announcing her retirement in July 2005, Supreme Court Justice Sandra Day O'Connor declared, and I quote, "In all the years of my life, I don't think I've ever seen relations as strained as they are now between the judiciary and some members of Congress, and it makes me very sad to see it." She continued, "The present climate is such that I worry about the future of the federal judiciary." Some prominent Republicans have also become deeply concerned about the extraordinary influence of religious groups in their own political party. John Danforth, who was an Episcopal priest before representing Missouri in the U.S. Senate, published an editorial in the New York Times in April of 2005 that said, Republicans have transformed our party into the political arm of conservative Christians. The elements of this transformation are parts of a larger package, an agenda of positions common to conservative Christians and a dominant wing of the Republican Party. The problem is not with people or churches that are politically active. It is with a party that has gone so far in adopting a sectarian agenda that it has become the political extension of a religious movement. Danforth wrote, "As a senator, I worried every day about the size of the federal deficit. I did not spend a single minute worrying about the effect of gays on the institution of marriage. Today, it seems to be the other way around." There's obviously a widespread, carefully planned, and unapologetic crusade underway from both sides to merge fundamentalist Christians with the right wing of the Republican Party. Although considered to be desirable by some Americans, this melding of church and state is of deep concern to those who have always relished their separation as one of our moral values. Chapter 7. Sins of Divorce and Homosexuality. Sometimes all of us Christians forget the scriptural assertions. Quote, "All have sinned and come short of the glory of God," and "Judge not, that ye be not judged." It now seems like a humorous incident, but I almost lost the presidential election by attempting to explain these kinds of biblical texts. I'll never forget my own consternation at the reaction when, during the 1976 presidential campaign, I answered a Playboy magazine reporter's question about whether I considered myself superior to other Americans because I was a Christian. I quoted some phrases from Jesus' Sermon on the Mount, in which he declined to distinguish between those who murdered and had hatred in their hearts, or between adulterers and those who looked on a woman lustfully. I denied having committed adultery, but stated that I had felt sexual desire for some girls I had known. There was a firestorm of criticism from my political opponents and famous church leaders because of my lust, and within a week I lost 10 percentage points in public opinion polls. As noted earlier, an interesting characteristic of fundamentalists is an obsession with one or two emotional issues, as with homosexuality among some religious factions. Many devout worshipers respect homosexuals but refuse to give such sexual relationships their religious blessing, while some other groups have chosen gays and lesbians as the foremost targets of their denigration. Leaders of the Southern Baptist Convention, for instance, have elevated homosexuality to a pinnacle of great importance among deviations from their increasingly narrow and rigid definition of the Christian faith. An even more disquieting claim is that HIV/AIDS is God's punishment on those who have sinned and should be treated accordingly. Jesus had encounters with lepers, who were also looked upon as sinful, condemned by God, and capable of contaminating their neighbors. He set an example for us by reaching out to them, loving, healing, and forgiving them. The public condemnation and ridicule of gays has been increasingly promoted by a few demagogic religious leaders, and the political acceptance of this treatment tends to authenticate and encourage this discrimination. I remember that immediately after the terrorist attack of 9/11 on the World Trade Towers, Jerry Falwell said, and I quote, "I really believe that the pagans, the abortionists, the feminists, and the gays and lesbians who are actively trying to make that an alternative lifestyle, I point the finger in their face and say, you helped this happen." Pat Robertson, his host on the 700 Club television program, quickly agreed. Other more moderate Christians and denominations are also struggling with the gay issue, but rarely with the same personal condemnation and exclusion from Christian blessing. The altercations are usually limited to the church's ordination of gay ministers and the performance of religious weddings between gay couples. Although Jesus Christ never included homosexuality among his very strict reminders of deviations from a perfect life, St. Paul does include homosexual acts among a long list of his other concerns, but he was always careful to interweave admonitions against the condemnation of others. And as all Christians know, Paul emphasized repeatedly that all of us are sinners, that the wages of sin is death, but that through faith in Christ we can be totally forgiven. One of my Christian heroes is Dr. Jimmy Allen, the last moderate president of the Southern Baptist Convention. His family has suffered severely from the ravages of AIDS and the refusal of Baptist congregations to accept some suffering members of the Allen family into Christian fellowship. He says, and I quote, "Our problem is not the definition of sin. It is the understanding of grace. If we truly love the person, we can deal with his or her deviant behavior." He added, "What we have a difficult time doing is to hate the sin but love the sinner." Admittedly, such a biblically balanced position will not be universally applauded by the gay community, nor will it be universally accepted by the straight community. But we will hear, "Well done, good and faithful servant," from the one who counts, as we learn to love in the Spirit of Christ. Unquote. I don't see any prospect for the multiple Christian denominations to resolve completely the debates about the religious status of gays and lesbians. But there is no reason for this issue to drive a wedge between us or for our country to be divided in the political arena. In fact, there is very little difference of opinion on this subject among political parties, with both presidential candidates in 2004 opposing gay marriages but approving legally recognized unions that would provide equal civil rights to gay or lesbian couples. Despite this agreement, the non-issue was hotly debated during the presidential campaign and pushed to the forefront by a few shrewd political demagogues who promoted defining marriage with an amendment to the U.S. Constitution. They knew this proposal to be politically infeasible, but kept the issue near the forefront of emotional debate about moral values. Since the punishment for adultery in the Christian era and more ancient times was death, and since Christ himself strongly condemned both adultery and divorce, a constitutional amendment with more biblical authenticity might be, quote, "Adultery and divorce are condemned, and marriage is defined as a legal and spiritual union between a man and a woman until they are parted by death." With a clear majority of Americans condoning divorce and believing it is acceptable for gays and lesbians to engage in same-sex behavior, it may be best to leave the U.S. Constitution alone. All of us consider family values and the stability of marriage to be extremely important. I never knew a divorced person before I went off to college, but divorce has now become alarmingly prevalent. Among all American adults, 25% have experienced at least one divorce, with the incidence varying by religious affiliation and age. Among major Christian groups, Baptists are at the top, 29%. With Catholics and Lutherans at 21%. Except for Asians, only 9%. Protestant senior pastors are the lowest group, 15%. Baby boomers have already reached 34%. Those between 53 and 72 years of age, 37%. And older citizens, only 18%. There are many reasons for this threat to the sanctity of matrimonial vows, but few would regard homosexuality as a significant factor in this multitude of failed marriages. Rather than letting the controversial issue remain so divisive among our citizens, perhaps we should separate the two basic approaches by letting government define and protect equal rights for citizens, including those of civil unions, and letting church congregations define holy matrimony. A law passed in Connecticut in April 2005, almost by consensus, extends to gay couples the same legal rights guaranteed to married heterosexuals, including family leave, tax and insurance benefits, and hospital visits, with a provision that defines marriage as a union between a man and a woman. This is a logical and simple division of responsibilities between church and state, with which I feel comfortable. Our only alternative is to perpetuate the unnecessary religious conflict and wait for the U.S. Supreme Court to give the ultimate answer to the legal questions. Chapter 8. Would Jesus approve abortions and the death penalty? First, abortion. Of all the sharply debated moral and political issues in America, abortion is the most divisive. Emotions run deep on both sides of the question, and they permeate both our nation's domestic and foreign policy. At the same time, there's a general consensus within our Christian churches that a developing fetus is a human life and should be protected. It is practically impossible to meld the two most extreme views on abortion, with one side claiming that this is strictly a decision to be made by a woman about her own body, with little or no regard for the fetus, and the other maintaining that a human being exists at the instant of conception and that murder results from any interruption of the embryo's development, or even the female ovum's fertilization by ejaculated sperm. There will never be any reconciliation between these true believers. I am convinced that every abortion is an unplanned tragedy. brought about by a combination of human errors, and this has been one of the most difficult moral and political issues I have had to face. As president, I accepted my obligation to enforce the Roe v. Wade Supreme Court ruling. At the same time, I attempted in every way possible to minimize the number of abortions through legal restrictions, prevention of unwanted pregnancies, the encouragement of expectant women to give birth, and the promotion of foster parenthood. I was bombarded with questions about abortion from the news media throughout my political campaigns and my presidency. One of my best remembered and most often quoted remarks came at a presidential press conference in July 1977 when I defended my lack of support for federal funds to be used for abortions among poor mothers, even though wealthier women could afford to have their pregnancies terminated. Without any careful forethought, I responded to a question on this issue by saying, "Life is often unfair." I could see then and now a clear opportunity to make substantial reductions in the need or desire for abortions while protecting the basic rights of a pregnant woman as prescribed by the Supreme Court. I advocated the evolution of more attractive adoption procedures, hoping to encourage the birth of a baby who might be unwanted or unplanned, and at the same time meet the desire of would-be parents to obtain a child. My administration also gave top priority to health care for new mothers and their babies. In summary, I tried to do everything possible to prevent unwanted pregnancies and to encourage prospective mothers to deliver their babies. Without any apologies, I addressed the issue with this somewhat simple approach that, quote, every baby conceived should be a wanted child. Frank and effective sex education is critical for teenagers, with a primary emphasis on abstinence, but also information about safe and proven birth control methods. Many fervent pro-life activists do not extend their concern to the baby who is born and are the least likely to support benevolent programs that they consider socialistic. They ignore the fact that once a doubtful mother decides not to have an abortion, she and her family usually have a number of needs: continued education for the mother, or maternity leave from a job, special health care with insurance to cover the costs, housing allowances, an adequate minimum wage, and tax credits to help the employed mother and her child have a decent life. 2/3 of women who have abortions claim their primary reason is that they cannot afford a child. There are two main sources of data on abortions in the United States, the Alan Guttmacher Institute and the Centers for Disease Control. And their latest report in 2002 indicates that 47% of women who have unintended pregnancies resort to abortion. 6 in 10 of these women are already mothers, with 40% being white, 32% black, and 20% Hispanic. More than half are in their 20s, and about 15% are teenagers. There's no clear pattern of race, age, marital status, or previous children. The most prevailing common factor is poverty, with 6 out of 10 abortions occurring among those with incomes below $28,000 per year for a family of 3. With economic prosperity and strong social services, American abortion rates reached a 24-year low during the 1990s to a rate of only 16 per 1,000 women of childbearing age. It has long been known that there are fewer abortions in nations where prospective mothers have access to contraceptives, the assurance that they and their babies will have good health care, and at least enough income to meet their basic needs. The most notable examples are Belgium and the Netherlands, where only 7 abortions occur among each 1,000 women of childbearing age. In some predominantly Roman Catholic countries where all abortions are illegal and few social services are available, such as Peru, Brazil, Chile, and Colombia, the abortion rate is 50 per 1,000. According to the World Health Organization, this is the highest ratio of unsafe abortions. One of the well-meaning but counterproductive approaches is to refrain from teaching our young people how to avoid pregnancy, instruction that is provided thoroughly and persistently in other nations. There is now skyrocketing federal funding for sex education, but unfortunately, most often with a strict prohibition against mention of any kind of contraception. Despite the fact that 60% of our American teenagers report having sex before they're 18 years old. A New York Times article reveals that Canadian and European young people are about equally active sexually, but deprived of proper sex education, American girls are 5 times as likely to have a baby as French girls, 7 times as likely to have an abortion, and 70 times as likely to have gonorrhea as girls in the Netherlands. Also, the incidence of HIV/AIDS among American teenagers is 5 times that of the same group in Germany. It is obvious that our teenagers are mature enough to be given the facts about sex and deserve to be able to protect themselves, preferably by abstinence, but with the wise use of contraceptives if that is their deliberate choice. Some of our government's international policies are equally counterproductive. In March 2002, Rose and I joined Bill Gates Sr. and his wife Mimi in a trip around the periphery of Africa designed to explore the optimum investment of funds from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation in reducing the terrible impact of HIV/AIDS. We met with a wide range of citizens, from prostitutes to national leaders, and we learned that there were notable successes in Uganda and Senegal, and terrible failures in Botswana, the Central African Republic, and South Africa. Kenya, Ethiopia, and Nigeria seemed to be holding their own, with about 6% of the population being HIV positive. The most effective approach was a bold presentation of explicit sex education and the use of condoms to prevent the infection, combined with inexpensive retroviral treatment of pregnant women to reduce the incidence of HIV infection among their newborn babies. Although costly, treatment was also needed for already infected adults to ease suffering and prolong life. There are members of the U.S. Congress who attempt to prevent the use of foreign aid funds for any form of family planning services in other countries. Now, with support from the White House, their amendments are almost invariably inserted into the most benevolent legislation. The impact of this policy is counterproductive if the purpose of the development assistance is to ease pain and suffering, to improve the lives of adults, and to reduce the infant mortality rate. In private, some of these legislators are quite cynical about third world countries, while admitting that they are succumbing to rigid pro-life political pressures. They claim that, in any case, the saving of children's lives only contributes to overpopulation and more future suffering. Surprisingly, statistics reveal just the opposite. Parents breed fewer children when their infants have a better chance to survive, with the result that population growth and infant mortality rates are proportionally related, increasing or decreasing together. The sanctity of life is a basic moral issue and should be a religious and political commitment. At the same time, there's a balancing act that must be evolved. One hotly debated issue involves stem cell research. It has been proven scientifically that a fertilized human egg, about the size of the period at the end of a sentence, can provide cells that are very flexible in their use, with prospects of preventing or curing a number of diseases, including diabetes, Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, and spinal cord injuries. With strong public support from distinguished Republicans, including Nancy Reagan and Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger, California voters approved a referendum in 2004 to establish a massive program of stem cell research, and subsequent public opinion polls show that at least 3/4 of Americans support such efforts. Despite this public support, some right-to-life activists and President Bush strongly oppose any introduction of new stem cell lines. The president points out that a few older lines are already authorized and states that the question is, quote, whether or not we use taxpayers' monies to destroy life in order to hopefully find cures for terrible disease, unquote. The few human stem cell lines available for government-funded research are usable, but were grown with mouse cells, a requirement that scientists are working to eliminate. In the meantime, an almost uncontrollable impetus continues for expanded research. A bipartisan majority of members of the U.S. House and Senate support carefully restricted legislation that would not create any new cells for research, but would allow the use of some of the excess frozen embryos in fertility clinics, if parents agree to offer them for this limited purpose. About 2% of the estimated 400,000 frozen and unused embryos wind up being given to other families who desire children, while the others are being destroyed. The proposed law would permit the use of a few of these, while prohibiting the use of taxpayer money to create new embryos by cloning or other means. Despite these restraints, the president has promised to veto any such legislation. A startling announcement in May 2005 revealed that South Korean scientists have developed a revolutionary scientific procedure that holds great medical promise. Using cells donated by people suffering from diabetes, spinal cord injuries, and other afflictions, they have created new stem cell lines that can genetically match those of the injured or sick patients. It is clear that the subject of life before birth will continue to be one of the most hotly debated in religious, political, and scientific terms. There's a strong religious commitment to the sanctity of human life, but paradoxically, some of the most fervent protectors of microscopic stem cells are the most ardent proponents of a death penalty. And now let's talk about the death penalty. When I was governor of Georgia, there was an intense competition among my peers in other states to determine which of us could achieve the greatest reduction in our prison populations. We spent a lot of effort on institutional reform, bringing in experts on various means of classifying new inmates to prepare them for basic education, career training, and psychological rehabilitation in prison, all followed by early release and work release programs. I was personally involved in the recruitment of volunteers from Lions, Rotary, Civitan, and Kiwanis service clubs who were trained to serve as probation officers with a singular duty. Each had to agree to adopt one prospective parolee, become acquainted with the inmate's family back home, and find a job for the person when parole was granted. At that time in the 1970s, only 1 in 1,000 Americans was in prison. That policy has been completely abandoned and reversed, as our nation's almost total focus is now on punishment, not rehabilitation. This is a characteristic of fundamentalism. I am right and worthy, but you are wrong and condemned. More than 7 Americans out of 1,000 are now imprisoned, most of them for nonviolent crimes. This is the highest incarceration rate in the world, exceeding Russia's former record of 6 per 1,000. Among the busiest construction industry in many states is building more jail cells, and job opportunities for prison guards have skyrocketed. One of my successes as governor of Georgia bragged to my wife that his greatest accomplishment while in office was building enough prison cells to reach from the state capital all the way to my hometown, a distance of about 45 miles. Our state's 2-strikes-and-you're-out law will help to keep this punitive industry flourishing. In addition to imprisonment, the United States of America stands almost alone in the world in our fascination with the death penalty, and our few remaining companions are regimes with a lack of respect for basic human rights. 90% of all known executions are carried out in just 4 countries: China, Iran, Saudi Arabia, and the United States. In fact, our nation and Somalia, which has no organized government, are the only 2 that have refused to ratify the International Covenant on the Rights of the Child, which prohibits execution for crimes committed by children. Since 1990, only 7 countries other than the United States had executed people for crimes they committed as juveniles. And even those, Iran, Pakistan, Saudi Arabia, Yemen, Nigeria, China, and the Democratic Republic of the Congo, now have disavowed the practice. Finally, in March 2005, the U.S. Supreme Court voted 5-4 to outlaw juvenile executions, a decision strongly condemned by many conservative Christians. It seems somewhat illogical to say, "You have violated God's commandment, thou shalt not kill, so therefore I will kill you." Unfortunately, that is the philosophy of a dwindling number, but still a slight majority, of Americans. In 1972, the Supreme Court ruled that capital punishment, as it was then administered, was cruel and unusual, and therefore unconstitutional. On July 1, 1976, however, the court overturned the ruling by a 7-2 decision while imposing some restraints, and capital punishment was reinstated. I've always considered myself fortunate that while I was governor and president, there were no executions under my jurisdiction. One of the key reasons proponents of a death penalty put forward is that it is a strong deterrent to murder and other capital crimes. In fact, the evidence shows just the opposite. The homicide rate is at least 5 times greater in the United States than in any European country, none of which authorizes the death penalty. The southern states carry out over 80% of the executions but have a higher murder rate than any other region. Texas has by far the most executions, but its homicide rate is twice that of Wisconsin, the first state to abolish the death penalty. It is not a matter of geography or ethnicity, as is indicated by similar and adjacent states. The number of capital crimes is higher, respectively, in South Dakota, Connecticut, and Virginia, all with a death sentence, than in the adjacent states of North Dakota, Massachusetts, and West Virginia, without the death penalty. Furthermore, there has never been any evidence that adding the death penalty reduced capital crimes, or that the crimes increased when executions were prohibited. Some devout Christians are among the most fervent advocates of the death penalty, contradicting Jesus Christ and justifying their belief on an erroneous interpretation of Hebrew scriptures. An eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, their most likely response, overlooks the fact that this was promulgated by Moses as a limitation, a prohibition against taking both eyes or all of an offender's teeth in retribution. Also, we might remember Jesus' explanation that Moses gave these and some other aspects of the Torah, including divorce, to accommodate the hardness of heart of his listeners. The Bible has numerous examples of mercy as an alternative to the prescribed death sentence, as when God permitted the first known murderer, Cain, to live and threatened a sevenfold vengeance against anyone who harmed him. Another interesting scripture is found in Ezekiel 33, where God says, "I have no pleasure in the death of the wicked, but that the wicked turn back from his ways and live." Perhaps the most vivid example of God's forgiveness and restitution is King David, who committed adultery with the beautiful Bathsheba and then had her husband Uriah killed. In another dramatic instance, Jesus forgave a woman sentenced to be stoned to death for adultery. It seems logical that all Christians would follow the example of Jesus Christ, but there is an inexplicable difference between most Protestants and Catholics. The Catholic Church has taken a firm stand against the death penalty, acknowledging that sovereign governments have a legal right to take the life of a guilty person as punishment, but only if there is no alternative. Pope John Paul II wrote, and I quote, "The nature and extent of the punishment must be carefully evaluated and decided upon, and ought not to go to the extreme of executing the offender, except in cases of absolute necessity. In other words, when it would not be possible otherwise to defend society. Today, however, as a result of steady improvements in the organization of the penal system, such cases are very rare, if not practically non-existent." Unquote. In 1999 in St. Louis, the Pope described capital punishment as cruel and unnecessary. And the same year, on Good Friday, America's Catholic bishops issued this appeal, and I quote, "Increasing reliance on the death penalty diminishes all of us. It is a sign of growing disrespect for human life. We cannot overcome crime by simply executing criminals."